Now, it's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, here on this fall morning. I'm here with co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. Yes, it has certainly become fall quite quickly.
It did.
You know, you'd never know it in the afternoons, though, because it's been in the 80s.
Yeah, it gets up there. It's up.
But I don't know. I guess it must be in the low 70s in the morning?
50s, actually.
50s, actually.
Yeah. I remember walking out without a jacket on, thinking, "Boy, this was a mistake," you know.
Yes, but then again, like, you know, before you know it, like 1-2 o'clock, it's in the 80s.
Yeah, it's a great time of year for weather. I mean, I love it. You know, little break from the, you know, oppressive humidity. But you know, on the back end of this is, you know, here it comes. You know, winter. And as much as I enjoy the change of the seasons, I wish winter was like 3 days long, and then we could just get a taste of it and get out and go on. You know. But it is what it is. It's the Northeast. What can you do? You know?
So I'm glad that you could be with us today. Again, on the show, we sort of bare our souls. And in preparing for the show this morning, I found out that your mom had passed away.
Yes, yeah. She passed away last Tuesday. And, you know, Merlio Girlio, we used to call her. And she was like the queen mom, you know. My mother was English. And yeah, she had a good run. She was 92 when she passed away, and the last year was a struggle for her. You know, I mean, it was in and out of hospitals and dialysis and all the other stuff that goes along with aging. And so it became, I think she just kind of, you know, I think she was ready. I think she just kind of gave up, you know, at some point, you know. And it's always sad, you know, to become an orphan. But, you know, at the end of the day, she had a good run. She was 92 years old, and you know, up until last year, pretty healthy.
It's so interesting that you just said what you did, because that strikes me when I find out, because we're of the age when a lot of people's parents are passing or have already had one of their parents pass, and it occurred to me that then many of us become an orphan. But I don't really hear anybody else talk about it that way. So it was just very interesting that you did.
Well, orphanhood is often thought about with children, you know. I mean, horrible when both parents die and you're still a child. But you're an orphan, you know, no matter what age you are. And it's just, it's kind of a, there's a finality to it, I think, that where, you know, you finally, both parents have gone and you're next to the one to pull into the garage, you know. So it is what it is. And, you know, it's all part of the process.
But I guess many of our listeners would be able to relate, and I don't want to get too personal for you, but your mom lived out of town. Mm-hmm. And that being said, how did you deal with her issues? You said she was in and out of hospitals, going to doctor's appointments. I know in my life, my mom's had some doctor appointments and stuff recently, and it takes a lot of dedication. I'm not looking for praise, Ma, but the reality is it's a time-consuming, and it takes some dedication. And I'm just curious how it is, if it's easy or harder when your parent is out of town and you're dealing with this stuff.
I would think it's a lot harder. I mean, we were fortunate in the fact that my sister lives across the street from my mother down there, and so my sister, you know, bore most of the responsibility for all of that, you know, which is, and it's hard. It's, you know, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, you become the parent again, you know, for the parent, you know. Excuse me, the parent becomes a child and you become the parent. So it was difficult. It, you know, it's hard. It's just hard. You know, they become, you know, feeble and, you know, unable to care for themselves in certain areas of their life. They have to be, you know, aided, I guess, is the word. Yeah, that's why they call them home aides, you know. But we had one of those, you know, who used to come in and, you know, help her out. But, yeah, it's the end of an era, I think, about, you know. I knew her the longest, you know, because I was the oldest. So, you know, we had a 70-year relationship, my mom and I. And it's sad. It's just sad, you know, no matter how much you understand it, and you know it's part of the process. It's always just, you know, you have to get through it. You know?
Life is such an interesting journey because, you know, I have one friend that prophesizes to me that, you know, when somebody passes, everybody drops everything and goes running to be at the funeral.
Sure.
Yet they, when their friend or family member is alive, then never see each other. So he always, you know, makes the statement, let's enjoy life while we're here.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I mean, you know, obviously the funeral is the obligation part and everybody runs to that, you know.
Yeah, and that be said, you know, when people do get ill and if you're geographically close, you know, how do you figure out the right amount of time to spend? Like, I know my dad was in a rehab center for quite a while, and it was trying to figure out the right mix of obligation, desire, and at the same time trying to have a continuity in my own personal life. And people would suggest to me, like, you know, well, how much time did you spend with your dad when he was healthy?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you know, we definitely at least once every 2 weeks or if we could, you know, weekly or whatever.
Yeah.
Because there was always needed to be some times to remind me that I wasn't doing the right thing.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Well, yeah, of course, that's a parent's job.
I'm certainly not the most perfect person, and Dad had his reasons to lecture me. I won't deny that. But when he was in the rehab center, I found myself going there every day.
Yeah.
And again, I was fortunate. It was right there.
Sure.
But I was tortured in my mind about that. And then I got into a mindset that I was lucky that it was so close and I'm a salesman during the day, that I'm running around, that I could jump in for 5 minutes, say my piece,
sure,
and then move on, maybe even get back later that night.
Yeah.
So for me, I had that interesting mix. But not everybody does. And again, life is a series of balancing acts,
yeah,
and you just got to do the right thing. But I try to live my life personally without regrets. So I always like to do my due diligence so that the future is as stressless as possible, because I create enough stress for myself
I can imagine. No, it's an odd thing, you know. I mean, I remember my grandparents. I was very close to my grandparents. And when they moved to Florida, you know, they were down there. They used to go down for a month or two in the winter. And then all of a sudden, it was like they were down there 6 months, and then they were down there full time. And distance creates a problem. And I think that, you know, I kind of lost touch with them. As you don't see them, you know, on a weekly basis like I did when they were up here, you know. It's the same thing with my mother. I mean, she moved to Florida, and you know, that distance creates this separation, and you kind of lose, you know, you don't lose the love or bond or whatever, but you just lose the contact, you know, that you would have normally if they were around. And I remember talking to my daughter about that, saying that I would vow not to really be any place where the grandkids weren't, you know. I mean, there's a part of me that says, you know, Florida weather-wise looks pretty good to me, but I just don't want to create that space, you know, and lose touch with them, because no matter what your intentions are, you know, it gets in the way. I remember when my daughter was five, I was divorced and pretty friendly with my ex-wife, and still am, actually. But I had this opportunity in Maui. I had a guy who I knew. I was dating this woman who was living in Maui, so I was commuting back and forth. You can imagine what a show that was. Anyway, her boss had this restaurant called Sam's on the beach, and it was right on the beach. I mean, I don't think the water lapping up on the sand was 50 feet from the doors of the restaurant, you know, the back doors of the restaurant. And so he said to me, look, I'm in the restaurant business, and I don't know why, and I don't want to be in it. He says, I'll tell you what, I will give this place to you. You can have it. No money. Just come in, run it, you know, send me a check once a month, and, you know, here you go. And I'm thinking, wow, I could have a waterfront restaurant in Maui, you know, for free, pretty much. I'm like, okay, how am I going to work this out? Well, I have a 5-year-old. I have to get back and see her. So once a month, I'll fly back, you know, from Maui to New York, and you know, I could spend 2 or 3 days and get. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, what am I doing? You know, I can't leave this little kid. You know, number one, number two, you know, all good intentions aside, you know, that flight between Maui and New York would get old in a hurry. You know what I mean?
That's for
sure. I've done it 100 times. It's a mess. You know. And obviously, I just passed on. I said, you know, thank you, but I can't do that, you know. And I was just afraid that that separation would have been the death knell, you know, to the relationship with my child. And I tease Courtney about it all the time. As it wasn't for you, I could have had a restaurant in Maui, you know, painted the you-know-what, you know. That kind. But it was a pretty easy decision, actually.
Well, it's interesting. The other thought that came to my mind in trying to understand, you know, our journey here, and I promise our audience we won't be dwelling on all this all show.
I'll weave this into food if it kills me. I'll just,
but in respect to Tom and his mom,
we
will make references to mom because I want to hear about some of her input into where you became today as a chef and author. But it's interesting. I guess as you get older, your pool of friends and associates gets bigger. So it's, you know, when you're a kid, you got 10 friends or whatever. By the time you're 60, you're in business, your family's expanded. All of a sudden, there's hundreds of people in your life, and trying to keep up with everybody and everything is crazy. And in today's world, I guess there's this thought of FMO, fear of missing out. And everybody's connected because not only is it just physical presence today, everything's an electronic connection because we can reach out to anybody across the country.
Yeah.
It used to be long-distance phone calls were expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all that's disappeared. Yeah. So there's just so much ability for you to have a larger population
I think it's more acquaintances, you know. I mean, I'm when I take an inventory of my friends, I don't think I've really made new friends, many new friends in the last 20 years. I mean, guy like you notwithstanding, Dorio notwithstanding, there's a couple here and there. But for the most part, my life is I don't want to say littered, peppered, let's say, with, you know, lots of acquaintances that I've met in the restaurant business or whatever. And I live, you know, a semi-public life, you know, so there's always that swirling around, you know. People are, I mean, I ran into somebody last night who was, I know you were here at the club, and why don't you come over to our club? Our food is terrible, and you know, I did a fundraiser with Sting of all people, at a home in Mill Neck for the deaf and the school for deaf children, and my friend's son had gone there, you know, so. Because of that, I went over there and I did the food for Sting's little mini concert. And so I hadn't seen her since then. I didn't really remember. And she was carrying on about, you know, oh, yeah, you know, this one and that one. And she's my friend. And I know you know her. And I do. I know all these people. But they're not friends, really. They're just, you know, people that I know. So I think that definition, you know, I have like Roger Vai, who's been my friend since, you know, the dawn of time. My friend Marty, who I met when I was 18 or 16 or whatever, must have been 16 because I was drinking underage. He got mad when he found out I was 18. He was the bartender. Jeff, who passed away, you know, and a few more. But, you know, that's kind of the short list of it. And, you know, on the acquaintance side, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of acquaintances. And, you know, it's funny with work friends. Work friends are a really an interesting phenomena that I think there's probably been social studies on it or whatever, but there's people that you know, if you work in a place 3, 4, 5 years, there's people that you're with every day, so you're kind of on it, and you know, with buddies, you go out to, you know, have a cocktail and, you know, parties to get a whole thing, and then, you know, you sell the restaurant or you move to another job and you never see them again for the rest of your life. It's the oddest dynamic, you know.
You're right. You spend more time with them. I mean, there's a term about with males, their work wife.
Right.
And there's women that you work with day to day that you spend more time than your married spouse.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, I it is interesting that, yeah, once the connection is broken, it's sort of.
Yeah, and that's the indication between a real not a real friend, but a friend and an acquaintance. You
sure,
know, is that
sure, sure.
The ease of which you can let it go, you know.
Sure.
So,
well, let's take a break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back. I, again, really would like to get a little insight into how Mom affected and
sure.
got you into the culinary business. And maybe even her, maybe she led you into the land of being an author.
All right, we'll check that out.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Francesca, a wine produced from Alto Alagir. This region is home to another famous Santa, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up a bottle of Santa Francesca at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle Hampton in Southampton, and Bottles and Cases in Huntington. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me, chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing With Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle radio show with your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, yeah, and not necessarily in that order. I'm an author more than a restaurateur these days, you know, as a plug to my book.
Well, you're elusive because the two ongoing restaurants are out east,
mm-hmm.
And I guess you – what would you actually your title be at the country club that you're
I mean, they call me executive chef. You know, job titles in my business are thrown around real loosely. You know, this executive thing is, like, silly, I think. You know, an executive chef is basically somebody who, you know, works in a big operation, like a, let's say, a, you know, a Hilton hotel, right? And it's basically an office job. It's not really a cooking thing. You know, you're kind of, you know, you're doing scheduling, you're doing food costing, you're doing analysis, you're doing, you know, training, you're writing programs. That's what an executive chef is. I mean, it's a guy who walks around, you know, with black dress pants and dress shoes and a nicely pressed chef jacket with the, you know, the logo of wherever he works on it, on the collar, you know, or the breastplate or whatever. And so, you know, when somebody calls himself like the executive chef of, you know, Amano, you know, to me, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a 60-seat restaurant. I mean, you're executive my rear end. You're in there cooking. I mean, you know, even at the country club, I mean, my title, official title is executive chef, but I'm on the line. I'm kind of back to my roots there. You know, I'm covered with, you know, sauce and you know, I look like the victim of a culinary drive-by by the end of the night, you know. that's really what I like. I was, you know, I was just interviewed from Newsday. Erica Marcus came in and sat with me for about a half an hour, 40 minutes, talking about my book and my transition from restaurants to country clubs and, you know, why I did it and this, that, and the other thing. And the funnest, if that's a word, part about it to me is that I actually can get back to why I got into this business in the first place and why I stayed in it so long. And it's really about the food and the art of cooking and the plating and the things that, you know, get me out of bed in the morning. It's certainly not, you know, the things I had to deal with the restaurants and still do on a limited level because I have a partner. But, you know, I'm not dealing with employee shenanigans, you know, who's, you know, in the men's room with who and, you know, who's, you know, going out and drinking and who, you know, came into work late and then the HR stuff, you know, who grabbed whose rear end and how come I'm getting sued. And then you have the government coming in every 20 minutes telling you there's a new tax or a new, you know, fee or whatever. So I'm kind of insulated from all of that. And I'm allowed to just do what I do, which at this stage of my life is fun, you know. And so I think it was my friend Roger who said to me, you know, when are you going to retire? You know what I mean? Because I'm 69 years old. Although I don't look a day over 67, I'm 69 and, you know, he's the same age. He just retired a year ago. And I said, I don't think you ever really retire from art. You know, like who retires from music? You see these guys, you know, the Stones or, you know, Mick Jagger's 120 years old, right? He's still out there prancing around like a chicken. You don't retire from sculpting or painting or, and I don't think you retire from food. If you approach it like it's an art form, which I do, it's not a business. I mean, I think if I was in a steakhouse, you know, cooking rare, medium, or well every day, 200, 300, 400 dinners a night, I'd have had it by now. But to be able to do what I do on my own terms, which the club allows me to do, you know, with certain restrictions, but they're not bad. And you know, I can basically do whatever I want to do and go into work and make whatever sauce, order whatever fish, get whatever wine. That's a hoot. You know?
But the little bit that I overlook your life, because we're always coordinating the radio show and sure. things like that, you're pretty dedicated to your cooking life. I mean, I guess having the flexibility, as you describe at the club, you could be wherever you want, whenever you want, and yet you're on a pretty tight schedule that you've created for yourself. I know there's certain days that you want to be at the club at a certain time, so the radio show can't be. You dedicate a little bit of time to yourself, which is, I guess, usually, I believe, Monday and Tuesdays type of thing.
Monday usually, yeah.
So, but again, there's this work mentality where, in today's world, it's definitely lacking. We've talked about this before, not to rant and rave real quick, because we want to do get into some food discussion, but when I go into a workplace and see people with earbuds and they're listening to podcasts and music, and if I'm doing a desk job, I'm supposed to be spending my time on that desk job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think when there's a music maybe on, you know, coming from the speakers in the room or whatever, it seems more background. When it's in your ear, it seems more direct to me. Again, I could be all wrong. I'm not the eternal answer to things.
Yeah.
But if I had headphones on when I was a youth working on Saturdays with my dad, here's my dad again, I'd get my butt kicked.
Of course, you know, and rightfully so. I mean, listen, I don't allow any music in the kitchen, and it's an odd dichotomy because I'm a musician. So, you know, I mean, there's a story, I don't know if I've told it before, a legendary story about me when I was in Montauk. I had a guy come in who was basically a good guy, and he was helping me out in the off season because we had lost most of the help. You know, it was just me and my Antiguan guys. I had a couple of Antiguan guys at work, and they were getting ready to leave. So he was going to come in and help in the pantry, right? So the guy comes in, he's got a boombox. Now, this is back in the early 90s, right? They still have boomboxes, right? So he walks in with his boombox, and I'm looking at him like he's got three heads, and he doesn't really notice my disdain, you know, for the thing. And he's like 15 minutes late to begin with, which annoys me, right? And so now he's got this boombox. So instead of going down and getting changed and getting on his stuff, you know, he's adjusting the boombox. So he puts it up on the shelf, and he takes the one speaker off to one side, and he brings it over to the left, you know, on the wire about 20 feet, and he takes the other one off the right, and he brings it over here, and he's got his stereo thing set up. Now he's flipping through the CDs or the cassettes or whatever it was, picks out a Grateful Dead thing, which I don't really like them anyway, but, you know, whatever, puts it in, and he's got Sugar Magnolia blasting through the kitchen, right? So, and I can see the other guys going, you know, like, you know, shaking their head with their fingers in their eyes because they know I'm going to do something, right? So I go over and I shut the thing off. And I take the one speaker and I bring it back and I hook it back onto the boombox. I go get the other speaker, hook it back onto the boombox. I pull the plug out. I take the entire boombox. I put it in the dishwasher. I close the door and hit the button, right? So now the guy's flipping out. He doesn't know what to do. So he's just standing there staring at me with his mouth open, you know? I never said a word. I went back and just started doing what I was doing. Not a peep, nothing, right? So he comes over to Preston later, my sous chef, and he goes, I guess chef doesn't want any music in the kitchen. And he goes, no, man, that was a very bad idea. He goes, that was all anybody ever said about it. But it went around Montauk like it was urban legend, you know. I still hear about it sometimes, you know. Hey, remember that time you put that thing in a dishwasher? Yeah, I remember, yeah.
That's a great story. Well, what's really interesting is I talked about a restaurant couple of shows ago, Branzino up in Melville,
yeah.
And apparently some of the people in the workplace don't trust me for knowing what I'm talking about.
Really?
I thought it was a nice restaurant.
Yeah.
So one Louise in the office, you know, mentioned to somebody, you know, hey, you know, do you ever eat at that Branzino up in Melville? And was shocked to hear that it was a really good restaurant.
Well, the great part about food, you know, much like music and art, is it's, you know, beauty's in the eye, in food case, beauty's in the mouth of the beholder, you know? And that's what makes, for me, restaurant going and wine tasting and food so much fun? Is it? It's like listening to music. I mean, I've had friends who like Sheryl Crow and what's her name, the lady from Miami, Celine Dion, and all of that. And to me, that's kind of like, it's almost fingernails on a blackboard, you know, where I'm more, you know, Steve Vai, Frank Zappa, Allman Brothers, Hendrix kind of guy, you know. And nobody's right or wrong. That's the great part. You know, listen, if, you know, I always say, how many times do we say, if you like a wine, drink it. I don't care if it's red, white, if it's fish, meat, whatever. Drink the wine. Who cares, you know? And it's the same thing. If you love a restaurant, I mean, I have people who are regulars in restaurants I wouldn't step foot in, you know? But who am I to tell them it's lousy? I mean, you know, you like it, go, you know? If you like Branzino, I'm okay with you going there still.
There you go. Thank you, Tom. So now, just to make myself feel bad, you were talking about music that you like. Mm-hmm. Are you into Clapton?
Yeah, I mean, I like Eric Clapton. I think he's a fine player, and I think he's one of the few people who were able to sustain himself over 60 years. I mean, which isn't easy in the music business because fads come and go so quickly. But he's a kind of a chameleon of sorts. I mean, he came out as this, you know, kind of like one of the first metal guys, you know. He was kind of hard, rocky, you know. Not quite metally like Zeppelin was probably the first, you know.
Yeah, it was that bluesy hard rock.
Yeah, you know, I mean, way back with the Yardbirds and then with Cream. Cream was a hard rock blues-based band. And then he went through that whole slow hand period. He was doing ballady stuff.
It's interesting you say that. So I feel bad because I should have thought of you when I had an extra ticket for Eric Clapton. And to make it matters worse, it was on a Sunday night or Monday night, which are probably two nights you might have considered going.
Step outside.
So I apologize without you even knowing why. But when you say that he went through this mellow part of his life, he did an acoustic set. You know,
he did albums that were kind of mellow, the slow hand thing. And then I remember watching him because I kind of lost track of what he was doing with his career. And I never really thought, you know, Clapton is God. I mean, I can name, you know.
I saw a shirt with somebody had on that said Clapton
is
God.
Yeah, it was that whole thing in the 60s where it was graffiti in London or whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is, you know, I can name 10 guys who are technically much better than Clapton, you know. But, you know, the bottom line is he does what he does, and he does it well, you know. He's a good songwriter. He's a good player. I mean, he can certainly play. I mean, I remember watching him doing he was playing along with a band that were doing a Bob Dylan tribute or something. And I hadn't seen him play in a long time. And he ripped one off, you know. And I went, whoa, that's the Clapton I remember, you know. But he's basically a blues-based guy. I mean, I can do some of the things that Clapton does. And I'm a cook, right? I'm not really a guitar player. I'm, you know, kind of a half-assed guitar player. But, you know, I mean, I can't even think about doing what Vai does or Guthrie Govan or Satriani or any of those. Al Di Meola. There's this other guy, Tommy Emmanuel, an acoustic guitar player who's ridiculous. You know, Jorma Kalkinen. I just discovered this new guy, Joshko Stefan. He was a German guy. He has this Gypsy Guitar Academy. He does a lot of that Django Reinhardt stuff. I mean, these guys are just so ridiculously talented. I watch them. I'm like, I want to burn every guitar I own, you know? It's like, what's the point, you know? But again, you know, I've seen Steve Vai Cook, you know, so I'm okay. You know what I mean? I do with food what he does with the guitar, you know? It's kind of he does with food what I do with the guitar. It's this complete role reversal thing. But it's just, you know, I think that, you know, getting back to the restaurant thing, you know, there's places I love that I know other chefs of mine don't, friends of mine don't, chef friends, I should say, and vice versa. So, you know, it's all subjective, and that's what makes it fun. I mean, you know, arguing over which wine is better than the other is kind of silly because if it's good for you, it's a 10. You know, if it's not, it's a 3, you know. So what's the point of arguing about it, you know? Drink it and enjoy it. You know?
That's for sure. So let's dig deep into your past. So, again, we're very sorry to hear about the passing of your mom this past week. But share with us her influence in your life. Again, as I do my introductions for the radio show, chef, author, and restaurateur. So, did mom have any insight into creating Tom Shordell the chef?
Well, in kind of a roundabout way, she did. My mother was English, and we all know about great English cuisine. The book is like 2 pages long, you know. If you go to any library and you go to a cookbook section in a store and try and find books of great English chefs, you know, you're going to be there for a while. It's made marked improvement, obviously, with the guys like Heston Blumenthal and you know, Gordon Ramsay for all his silliness. But, you know, now there's great restaurants in London, but the English were never known for their food. So my mom got married when she was 22. She had me when she was 23. So I was like, she was a baby having a baby. And you know, her mother was a terrible, my grandmother on my mother's side was a terrible cook also, because she was from Liverpool, you know what I mean?
There's some consistency there.
Totally. I mean, so my grandmother taught my mother what she knew, which was nothing, you know. And then my mother was thrown into this, you know, kind of family situation. She had 6 kids by the time she was 35, you know.
So, like, what was a typical week in the kitchen when you had, you know, family dinner?
Well, my mother had some menus. She had, you know, things that she did poorly, but she did. And then as she got older, she got better at it. You know, she obviously through cooking. I mean, she was cooking 365 days a year for basically 8 people, you know, every day. And she did it pretty much without complaining all that much, you know. And my father was a handful, too. So she had that to deal with. And then, you know, whatever. But her typical meal was, you know, spaghetti and meatball. You got to remember, too, my father was a fireman, you know, with 6 kids. So there was never a lot of extra money around, you know. And so it was spaghetti and meatballs. It was Mrs. Paul's fish sticks. You know, it was, you know, Frank's and beans casseroles, you know, kind of thing. So in a way, I kind of got into food through an accident of fate. You know, when my amp blew up, my guitar amp blew up for the 15th time, which was my fault. And my father said, if you think I'm giving you another dime for an amp, you're out of your mind. If you want to get a new amp or fix this one, go get a job. So I lied my way into a dishwasher's job at 15 and started. But even though it was a steakhouse, I started to get an idea that, wow, food tastes pretty good, you know, when it's not handled by my mother, you know. So in a way, and I'm not disparaging your mom if you're listening somehow up there, whatever, but, you know, it kind of got in the way. And it was almost a self-protection mechanism, because she was rough in the beginning, but then she got a couple of things. You know, Merle's meatloaf was legendary in the family. You know, she did a good job with that. And my mother made, to this day, the best salad dressing I've ever had in my life. And it was oil and vinegar. That was it. But she had a palate for it, and never mixed anything ahead of time, never measured it out that I saw. Would just take the vinegar and take the oil and toss the salad. Because we were like European. We had a salad every night for dinner, but it was always served after the meal, not before.
Really?
Yeah. It's a European thing. I think it's a cleansing mechanism or whatever. But anyway, and so the salad was always later. And I still, I'm a pretty good cook, you know. I can't duplicate that. And maybe it's just a romance thing in my head or whatever, but I just can't figure out my mom's salad dressing, which was just fabulous. You know?
That's pretty cool. That's
so she kind of she kind of pushed me that way through some terrible meals into appreciating what my grandmother cooked on my father's side. She was a great cook, so we used to go to Nan's house, and it was just like, oh my god, this is like a holiday because the food was so good, you know. And then as far as the restaurant business went, you know, my mother was funny. My mother didn't really, I remember her asking me when I was like, I don't know, 50, 55 years old. I'd already had about, I don't know, 8 or 9 restaurants, whatever. And, you know, I was considered fairly successful. And she goes to me, I can't believe you're going to go through your whole life without having a real job. And I'm like, what? She goes, you don't, why can't you get a real job? I'm like, believe me, I have a real job. I work 150 hours a week. That's a job, you know. Excuse me. So she goes, no, you know. Anyway, her idea of a real job was you had to have a pension, you had to have a boss, you know, it was just, excuse me, you had to work for the county or whatever. So it was kind of cute, you know. And the literary thing, she didn't really have much influence on that. That was more Miss Sayre, my ninth grade English teacher, who pounded me into doing work that I didn't want to do. And she inadvertently or almost accidentally lit up a love of writing in me that I enjoy to this day. But my mother, on the other hand, was her influence on me was about grit. You know, my mom had a lot of grit for a 105-pound, 5'2" lady. I mean, she was as tough as they came. You know, she would take me on with a belt and, you know, a frying pan or whatever. But she had it, man. She had, you know, she had no money. She had six children. It was hard for her. It was very hard for her. She had a rough life in the beginning. You know, it wasn't until, you know, we all kind of grew up where it kind of eased up for her. And so I think it was that and her, you know, her fastidiousness around the house. I mean, the house was always immaculate. And she just always did the best she could with what she had. And sometimes it wasn't a lot, but she always made the most of it. And I think that was the lesson in the end that I take from her, was that she was just a tough woman. And no matter what knocked her down, she always got up. And I think that's as important as any lesson anybody can learn in business or in life, is, you know, we're all going to have those knockout punches. You know, I've had them. I've had restaurants go down on me, whatever. And I think it's how you handle the failures that, you know, kind of prepares you for the success. I mean, it's, you know, I've learned more from my failures than any of the successes, you know. And I always tell people, embrace your failures. And I think that comes from my mother, because my mother was, you know, she had a lot of ups and downs early on in her life, and she always got up and always had kind of a good attitude about, oh, well, let's try again and we'll do it better next time or whatever. So I think that's the lasting legacy of Merle, you know.
That's very cool. So let me throw something at you. Say, turn the tables, it's a good time. Everybody from the family was coming up and was going to be at Tom's house out east.
Yeah,
and Tom was going to prepare a meal. What would you prepare for the Shawdell family?
Oh, my God. I don't even know. I'd probably take out, you know. It's like, I don't like to cook at home. It's a pain in the neck. I think that, you know, my family growing up, we ate simply, you know. I'm the only one that really has what you would consider an overeducated palate, you know. So it would probably be something simple, you know, roasted chicken or something like that, or a steak on the grill. Unless they all eat that way, you know. It's a steak and potato, chicken and potato kind of group, you know.
So wait, so that just sparks something. Sorry to interrupt, but being that you're associated with the club, I don't know if you get this part of it, but I don't go to a lot of weddings and bar mitzvahs or whatever at this point in my life, but we were invited to a friend's wedding, third wedding.
Oh, great.
Third time's a charm, as they say, down in
Florida. At that point, I don't think they should give you a marriage license. They should give you a learner's permit. You know?
Well said. Well said. So it's an upscale wedding down in Florida.
Yeah.
We got the invitation. Beautiful invitation. It's got a pop-up carved tree and
singing dog.
But this threw me for a loop. I get a text from Kerry saying, "Well, you have three choices for your main entree. What would you like to have?"
I know. What am I going to be in the mood for next October?
And I go, "What?"
Oh yeah, that's becoming more and more prevalent.
And then there was also, I guess because it's sort of a destination wedding, at least for a lot of the guests.
Yeah.
The bride and groom live down in Florida. There's, I guess, a rehearsal dinner. Then there's a post-reception brunch. And everything comes with a price tag.
You're paying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's is this the norm in today's world?
I don't know, but you know, here's a plug for my book again, A Second Helping, published by iUniverse, written by Tom Shawdell, available for you. We had a D-level celebrity, whose name I'll leave out for now, book a wedding at one of the restaurants, and at the end of the wedding, when my partner was preparing the bill, the celebrity came over and said, "We need separate checks." He goes, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, we need separate checks." He goes, "This is your wedding? You want me to give you separate? How am I supposed to know who drank what or ate what? I can't, you know, separate checks is insane. I'm not doing that." She goes, "Well, I don't know how you're going to get paid. I didn't bring any money." So who goes to a wedding with no money, right? So he says, well, that's not my problem. You want to collect? So she went to the guest and collected. It took her about 45 minutes. She finally had enough money to pay for the wedding.
Well, I'm led to believe in old folklore in the 30s and 40s. Like, if somebody had a wedding, like, the bride and groom would, like, go in the back room, open all the gifts, and then be able to pay for the wedding that night. I don't know if that's folklore or what, but...
Well, I'll give you one. I did a wedding. A woman came to me when I was out in East Hampton. And you have to understand, East Hampton was a very, very... that's the word. I'm torn on it. I mean, I love East Hampton. I love the East End. I consider it my second home. I lived there for a long time. But I had one of the biggest shocks of my life out there is... when I opened in 87 was the year that the stock market crashed. So you can only imagine what went on. And I struggled out there for about 3 or 4 years with a restaurant I had and finally just, you know, walked away from it. But we were really in financial straits at the time. And I got this call from this woman to a wedding who worked for Brides Magazine. And I'm thinking, wow, this is great. You know, I'll have a wedding which is going to bring in some cash. And, you know, I can get a spread in Brides Magazine. It'd be great for the catering company. You know, here's my answer, right? And as usual, whenever my ship comes in, I'm standing in the railroad station, you know what I mean? So make a long story short, we get this wedding together. And the night before the wedding, and it's a big wedding. It's like, I don't know, 200 people with a tent, the whole thing. The bride calls me up hysterically crying, "You've ruined my wedding, you bastard." This is the opening salvo. I'm like, what are you talking about? You ruined my wedding. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, the tent's striped. I can't have a striped tent at my wedding. I work for Brides Magazine, the whole thing. Striped? This is what are you talking about? I was just down here. It's white. It's striped. Ah, crying, you know, the whole thing, right? So I said, well, could you put your husband on the phone? I'm thinking I get some sanity there, right? He's crying. You ruined our wedding. I'm like, Jesus. You know, what, are you kidding me, right? So I said, I don't know what you're talking about. So I go down here to check the tent. Around the valance of the tent, there was a small yellow stripe that went around the valance. The rest of the tent, the whole tent's white. She makes such a scene, right, that I call the tent guy at like 11 o'clock at night. I say, you have to change the tent. The woman's freaking out over the valance. He says, you got to be kidding me. I can't, you know, you have to do this, dude, you know. I had to pay for a new tent, right? Now I'm out $6,000 or $7,000 or whatever it was. So we do the wedding. It turns out, there's kids running around naked. There's dogs. You know, there's no photographer from Brad's Magazine. This whole thing's a mess, right? Now I'm furious. This is the wedding that wouldn't survive a yellow stripe. I'm homicidal, right? So at the end of the wedding, the husband comes over to me and goes, Tom, I got to tell you, the wedding was really good. And I'm like, yeah, great. You know what I mean? Like, not in the mood, right? He goes, but I have a problem. Really? He goes, yeah. He goes, if I pay you the balance, I'm not going to be able to go on my honeymoon. So I said, John, if you don't pay me the balance, you're not going to be able to go on your honeymoon. You know, pick one. You know what I mean? Oh, I'm telling you. Anyway, he paid me. But so I was actually, that could have been the one that sent me right over the ledge. But, you know, people with weddings, it's just, it's nuts. It's just nuts, 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 nuts.
Incredible. So I have a seasonal story to share with you.
Please. It's got pumpkins in it.
It does, Tom.
I knew it.
So we always, or you always make the comment that, you know, you're out east and one day it's all green and you blink your eyes and the next day it's fields full of pumpkins.
It's Tumbleweed Tuesday, day after Labor Day.
So I had the occasion to attend a press conference for the Great Jack-O-Lantern Blaze, which is over at Old Bethpage Village Restoration.
Nice.
Appropriately in Bethpage.
Yeah.
And it's a Halloween event, a walkthrough.
Right.
And it's a combination of carved artificial pumpkins and carved real pumpkins.
Right, right.
And incredible artistry. They had some samples there, and they actually do these things with an X-Acto knife.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like, and so finely detailed, yeah. It's incredible. So when we got there, this happens in Nassau County, so, and it's a Nassau County Park, Old Bethpage Village Restoration.
It's a mouthful.
So, it's a mouthful. So they had the Nassau County logo carved on a pumpkin, which was pretty cool. And then they went on to say that this year they created a Long Island Hall of Fame. And there were going to be representations of, like portraits of Billy Joel and Joan Jett and other famous people on Long Island. And just to kick it off, they had our county executive, Bruce Blakeman's mm-hmm. resemblance on a pumpkin. And I can't share it because this is radio, but it was incredible. Unbelievable. And then over at Old Beth Page, they do old-time baseball, like with the mitts with just the pad. Yeah,
they had a cotton in them.
It's the old. So they had a representation of that. Just incredible. But I got to speak to one of the creative people there, and I shared your story. You know, you wake up one day, there's no pumpkins. And he goes, you know what it's all about? He goes, as you get into fall, the greenery disappears, and then the pumpkins are exposed. And that's what's going on.
I don't believe him. I think they're bringing them in from Pennsylvania.
You're probably still right. And then another quick story. So
the greenery doesn't go away in 12 hours.
You're probably right, Tom. I'm not a betting man, I think the logic in what you're saying is there.
He's lying to you.
So I'm driving around the South Shore earlier in the week, and lo and behold, I feel I'm like at the Jones Beach Air Show. There's this hovering sound of a jet engine, like a jet fighter, that they usually have on display over at Jones Beach. Mm-hmm. And I hear this deafening sound that I'm driving. I'm saying, what the heck is going on? The only thing that I used to hear probably 20 or 40 years ago is when the supersonic used to fly
break the
over.
Sound barrier or whatever.
You'd hear it every day. It was like 2 o'clock or something.
Oh, that was the Concorde.
The Concorde, yes. So I said, I don't know what's going on. And then all of a sudden, I see this jet fighter plane and balls of flames coming out of its tailpipes. And I'm going, that's really bizarre. You know, like, is the air show just practicing or something? And it's not even air show time.
Yeah.
And, I just went on my way. But the next morning, I read that apparently a Cessna airplane had taken off from MacArthur Airport and was flying in a no-fly zone because of the UN and Biden in town.
Yeah.
And they were trying to communicate with them, and there was no communication. They activated this Navy jet fight plane to essentially
shoot him down.
Knock it out of the sky. And apparently it chased it or it tailed it into Manhattan before they finally resolved the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But that's incredible. And then my mind started wandering. You know, how quickly can something like that be activated? So there must be somebody sitting in a hangar somewhere just waiting, or a whole group of people, because if a water were to break out, all these people are on standby. So it must be incredible plans of action that we're not familiar with to protect us.
So I'm going to bring that all back to food and say, you know, what do those pilots bring up there to eat? Do they have one of them bagels that they never cut through the whole thing? You know what I mean? Because you don't want to spill any cream cheese on all of that equipment up there in those planes, you know? But yeah, I heard the same thing. I mean, there was some, I have a friend who lives down on the South Shore, and she was telling me that there was planes flying all over the place down there. I don't know, it was one or two, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's some serious stuff. You know, you got all these political types trying to, you know, solve the problems of the world. And meanwhile, look at the shape it's in. It's the result of their talents in the first place. You know what I mean? And, you know, they're going to fix it. If you know how to fix it, it wouldn't happen. You know, please. I can't even. I'm so cynical about that stuff. Anyway, so getting back to
food.
The food thing, which was what we're supposed to do in the beginning. You know, I think that this is one of the most exciting times of the year to cook, and we have a guy who, you know where Coe Hall is, the Arboretum?
Yes.
It's right next to the club. We actually lease the driving range property from them.
Right, and just for our listeners, the club that Tom is talking about, the name of it is?
Mill River Club.
And it's in Old Brookville?
It's in Oyster Bay.
Oyster Bay, sorry.
Yeah, Brookville, Oyster Bay. Anyway, so we lease the driving range property from the Arboretum, so we have this you know, symbiotic relationship back and forth. So we're always doing things for them and they do things for us or whatever, you know. So there's a farmer over there and he reminds me of, who's that the character? Pigpen in Snoopy, you know, or whatever.
He's always got the dust
flying off him. So he looks like he comes in, he's always covered with dirt, you know, because he's what he does. He's a dirt guy, you know. And he grows all these great vegetables. He brings them home. And I use a lot of his vegetables on the menu, right?
He's a dirt guy. He might actually be considered a farmer.
He might be a farmer. He's got the hat, you know. So anyway, calls me up and he says, listen, I got this thing going on. You know, a bunch of restaurants are taking my vegetables and they're making platters up. You know, would you like to do a platter for us? I'm thinking, yeah, like I want an enema, you know. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm like, all right, you know, I'll do the platter for you, right? So I said, you know, bring me some stuff and I'll make some kind of a vegetable thing. He brings me about 70 carrots, about the same amount of parsnips, 12 white onions the size of a golf ball, and 12 red onions the size of a, what we used to call a spalding, you know, the pink ball, you know, and two kabocha squash and one pumpkin. What the hell am I supposed to do with that? So I'm thinking, okay, I can make a pumpkin hummus, like a dip for the steam the carrots, you know, with some sugar and honey. Do that. I'm thinking chips of the parsnip. I'll make like potato chips out of the parsnip, and I'll make an onion dip like my mother used to make without the, you know, Lipton soup stuff, you know, like a real one, you know. But it's like, dude, you really kind of, I got no color here. I have no variety here. It's all root vegetables. So I don't know. So tomorrow's project is to come up with some kind of interesting looking product or platter with carrots, parsnips, and onions. I'll be taking any kind of suggestion. Anybody who wants to write into fire at WLIR, WLIR, listen to me, WHLI, oops, that's the end. Well, this is the last show that we'll be doing here. Playing with fire is about to be extinguished.
So you know, that's interesting. So you had a slur of decades. So somebody made the comment to me that in the old days, an antipasto would be served at a gathering.
Right.
But today it's a charcuterie board.
Yeah. Well, antipasto, which means before the pasta. And it's an Italian term that signified appetizer because it came before the pasta, which came before the entree. Charcuterie board is a little different. Charcuterie board is, you know, it's salumi. It's you know, coppa and soppressata and prosciutto and, you know, any of that stuff. And then, you know, I usually use cheeses, although cheeses aren't technically charcuterie. It's tea and crumpets. It goes pretty well with that, so we serve that. And then a bunch of spreads and you know, like do pickled peppers or I'll do, you know, roasted balsamic onions or olives, things like that. You know, little kind of things that sort of go with, you know, cured meats and things of that sort. Breads and olive oil and that kind of thing. So that's the difference between charcuterie and antipasto, you know. But antipasto, you know, that whole... thing is kind of ambassadorized. I mean, you know, you go into these, you know, simple Italian restaurants and you get an antipasta salad, you know, and they take, you know, salami and some, you know, sort of manufactured cheese and, you know, cut it up and throw it into the salad. It's just, that's kind of not what it's supposed to be. Antipasta just means before the pasta.
You know? Well, yeah, as you would say on the typical Italian red sauce, Italian red sauce restaurant, mm-hmm. You know, there'd be a cold antipasto and a hot antipasto.
They're all the same, too. I mean, it's like baked clams, clams casino, you know, mussels, you know, mussels marinara.
Maybe stuffed pepper. Yeah,
I knew a guy named Mussels Marinara. He was grew up in Carr Place. But yeah, it's you know, a lot of these things evolve into what they are. And you know, it's funny with food how, you know, we've, some things become ubiquitous. I mean, up until 1970, you know, who ever had a Caesar salad with grilled chicken on it, you know? Now you can't not have it, you know? It's just...
Well, Well, Tom, the proper presentation of that would be, what protein would you like on your salad today, sir?
Yeah, yeah. And I get it that people are eating healthier and stuff. I mean, I have, you know, I was just telling someone last night that I have a, we're talking about purging and getting rid of stuff that's hanging around, right? I have a box in one of the closets in my house, and it's probably about 2.5 feet wide by 3 feet wide, and maybe about, I don't know, 3.5 feet deep, just filled with menus of places that I've been to in my life, you know. And I've been around a long time, so it's been, you know, I got a lot of menus, you know. And I was looking at it, I said, there must be 500-600 menus in here. And they're all different, obviously. And, you know, so that's the ones that I saved, you know. And I stopped saving menus a long time ago. I'm thinking, how many restaurants have I been to, you know? It's probably in the thousands at this point, which is kind of interesting, you know. And I was talking about, you know, somebody asked me where my, I did an interview for some magazine. I don't remember the name of it now, being with an A. Anyway, so they're asking me about influences and, you know, where they come from. And I'm like, you know, my influences come from everywhere. I mean, the seasons, first of all, you know, because, you know, you have the colors, which kind of go in your head, and the flavors and stuff like that. You know, cover to cover, I read probably 5 magazines a month. You know, I have 600 cookbook collection that I'm constantly referring to. But going out to eat is probably the biggest influence and kind of inspiration that you can get, because the stuff's right in front of you. You can see it and taste it. You can't taste it on a cover of a magazine. You can't taste it on a book. So going out and then watching the operation in as it's going on, you pick up on things that, you know, the waiter's doing, or the server's doing, or the lighting, or whatever. There's this tremendous inspiration in going out to dinner, you know. And, you know, you find out what you can do, and, you know, you kind of weave that into your own, you know, repertoire or whatever. Same with, you know, I get people come up all the time. Hi, my name's Jason, and I'll be a waiter today. It's like I want to punch him in the face. It's like, you know, the apron and the pen were a dead giveaway. I know you're going to be my waiter. I don't need to know your name. I mean, and it's not like it's a bad thing. It's just, I think it's the most annoying, trite little thing you could do. A serious restaurant, I don't need to know the waiter's name. He's basically going to bring me stuff and take it away. That's all I need. You know, I need you when I need you, and I don't when I don't, you know. So I don't need you coming over here and telling me, oh, that's a very good choice, sir. Oh, yeah, I would have one. Shut up.
You know? Well, I always get a kick out of when a patron at a restaurant will go to their waiter or waitress and say, you know, what would you recommend? So, if the person is recommending a signature dish of the restaurant, but the fact that the waiter likes chicken, what does that have to do with you?
I know. I've been out with people who are the pickiest eaters in the world. You know, what do you think I should have? Are you kidding? You're setting this guy up to fail. You don't like anything. You know what I mean? Pick something that you can gag down and we can get out of here with my dignity intact, you know?
But and that be said, and we probably talked about this before, but coming from your side of the table, when it comes to the the temperature or how well done a cut of meat is prepared, what's the best means of communicating with your server of what your desire is?
I think it's color, you know. I mean, medium rare. I mean, most places are within the boundaries of that, you know what I mean? But I think the person has to know. I mean, I can't tell you how many people tell us, I want my salmon rare. Yeah, okay. I know what's going to happen here. You're going to send it back 5 times until it's well done. You know, you think you want it rare until it comes out rare, and then it's a problem.
But that be said, not to get ridiculous, but, you know, if you get a steak that's 6 inches long, the middle is going to be different than the edge. So, I mean, I guess you're ordering it based on the...
Yeah, in the middle, you got to cut it through it, you know. I mean, I've had guys, you know, take off a piece off the side and say it's not medium rare. Well, of course it's not medium rare. It's the part that was sitting on a grill. You know what I mean? It's like, I want a new one. It's going to look the same, dude. It's going to look exactly the same.
But in your experience, you've obviously been there a while.
Yeah.
I mean, are there many battles about that?
Yes, yeah, occasionally, yeah. There are. On that note, next week I'll tell you about a few of them I've had. But we do have to end the show today with Tom's 3 keys to life, which is life is too short to drink bad wine. This is an abrupt an ending has ever had. Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex, pizza, and the timing of the show.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients: Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Francesca, a wine produced from Alto Alagir. This region is home to another famous Santa, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up a bottle of Santa Francesca at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle Hampton in Southampton, and Bottles and Cases in Huntington. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me, Chad@Savorian.com.